When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What physical science works well at, what it's all about really, is accounting for publicly observable behavior, right? Whether it's a complex living system, explaining it in terms of simpler mechanisms, ultimately postulating basic laws of physics that explain those more complicated forms of behavior. This is what the project is. This is what it's been so good at. This is what's given us incredible technologies, explaining publicly observable behavior. But that's just not what we're trying to do when we're trying to explain consciousness. We're not trying to explain some publicly observable behavior. We're trying to explain this inner world of colors and sounds and smells and tastes. It's just a totally different explanatory project. And, you know, there are a lot of steps to the argument, but I think it just doesn't make sense to we can't sort of capture these subjective qualities, what it's like to see red, what it's like to taste coffee, in the purely quantitative language of physical science. That's not what it's ever been aimed at. It's like saying, you know, oh, telescopes have been really good in astronomy. Maybe they'll be good in pure math.
Hello, this is Robinson Earhart here with the introduction to Robinson's podcast, number 204. And this episode is with Philip Goff, who is a professor of philosophy at Durham University in the United Kingdom, where he researches consciousness and the philosophy of mind. And Philip is undoubtedly the best known proponent of what is still a controversial view about consciousness, both within philosophy and without, which makes it particularly spicy, known as panpsychism. And panpsychism takes mentality or some primitive form of awareness or phenomenology to be fundamental in the world and residing in fundamental particles like electrons or strings, depending on your physics, rather than something that either emerges out of something complex or complex structures like humans or bats, or that exists parallel to natural objects like humans and bats in mysterious non-physical objects like souls or alternate dimensions. And in this episode, Philip and I start from the beginning with how philosophers think about consciousness in the first place before moving on to the various camps in the debate and how they answer or possibly fail to answer certain questions and objections. We also talk about parapsychology and free will and how they relate to panpsychism, and then Philip's new book, Why, the Purpose of the Universe, and where God fits into the fine-tuning problem, which is how the fine-tuning problem is how we should account for the surprising fact that given all the many possible ways in which physics could have been, it is just perfect. It's a very beautiful day here in Palo Alto for human life. So there are links to Why, the Purpose of the Universe in the description, or links to Why, the Purpose of the Universe and Philip's website in the description. Reviews, likes, comments, subscribes, these are always very helpful. On Spotify and Apple, I am currently at 4.9 stars because some people that really don't like the show decided to give it 1 star. And if you could give it 5 stars, I mean, that would be terrific, because having 5-star rating would make me a very happy guy. Other than that, there is a Patreon, a link to which is also in the description, in case you would like a link to an ad-free RSS feed for the show, or you would like some show notes, or you would just like to support Robinson's podcast, because Pins is, though small, she be mighty, and requires a great deal of chicken, and she prefers canned food, but she also gets very good chicken. Anyway, Without any further ado, I hope that you enjoy this conversation as much as I enjoyed having it with Philip. Philip, when I think about the most interesting problems for scientists and philosophers and for me as well, explaining consciousness is right up there at the top of the list. But before we get into how you think that we ought to do that, I'm wondering if this is the problem that got you into philosophy in the first place.
I think I've always been a little bit obsessed with philosophy as far back as I can remember, really. Just obsessed with sort of how things fit together. You know, I was raised Catholic, and I remember when I was very young, hearing about, you know, Genesis, Adam and Eve, also hearing about the Big Bang. And, you know, I was very interested in stars and black holes, and asked the priest, you know, what happened to Adam and Eve when the Big Bang happened? Where were they? So just that urge to try and, you know, make everything consistent. How do these different stories we tell about reality fit together? But I think it's consciousness that most grabbed me. Certainly when I went to university, undergraduate, I was most struck by the problem of consciousness. I think it's the most puzzling because it's so hard to deny the reality of the phenomenon. You know, with these other things like free will, value, abstract objects, these other things, troubling phenomena that philosophers struggle to fit into our standard scientific story of the universe, it's always an option at least to say maybe it doesn't exist. You know, maybe we're not really free in the way we think we are. Maybe value is really just projection of our feelings rather than something that's out there in factual reality. But with consciousness, you know, that the idea that nobody's ever felt pain or nobody's ever seen red just seems so intolerable. So it's so hard to deny the reality of the phenomenon, but it's so hard to fit into our standard story of reality. So yeah, that's what's always gripped me most of all.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. You didn't really say this, but I went to Catholic school and my mom was Lutheran. So I too was at a young age, like grappling with these questions. And I don't think I ever really believed in God and was very confused about why people did. But it's very funny to me how so many philosophers either seem to come into philosophy through religion or through physics and math.
Yeah, that's it. I don't know whether I'm not sure. That's interesting. And I'm not sure I'd say it was the religion that got me interested in philosophy. I was just using that kind of as an example of that, how we fit together the different stories we tell about reality, the stories we tell about value with the story of science could be another example. So I suppose that was just one that struck me early, but I'm not sure it was so much wrestling with the idea of God, although it's a while ago now, so it's a bit hard to totally pin down.
Well, we probably ought to start by defining some terms, or at least in the case of consciousness, attempting to do that. And just so we're on the same page to start off, is there a way of describing consciousness that you found is acceptable to most parties? Granted, though, that we aren't yet explaining what it really is or what causes it or anything like that.
The standard way it's defined in philosophy and science that most people seem to be okay with, although not everyone, is just to say consciousness is subjective experience, seeing color, hearing sound, feeling pain. Your consciousness, to put it in the way Thomas Nagel famously did in his paper, What's It Like to Be a Bat, from the 1970s, your consciousness is what it's like to be you. Right? So right now you're having visual experience of the room around you, hearing the sound of my voice, feeling the clothes on your body if you pay attention. This is all part of what it's like to be you right now, all part of your subjective experience. I mean, in a way, I haven't really defined it as such, at least I haven't defined it in other terms. I think it's something of a kind of primitive concept, but it seems to be one that people quite easily get onto. You know, I mean, teaching philosophy for many years now, there are many philosophical concepts that students struggle to get a handle on and what the hell are you talking about? But with consciousness defined as subjective experience, you just give a few examples and people seem to get onto it quite quickly on both sides of the debate, really. So not everyone's happy with that. Some people think, is there really a single unified concept here? But I'd say most people are happy to start with that and then run with it.
Mm-hmm. So in very early on in our conversation, you said that it is so hard to deny the reality of consciousness, unlike something like free will. But then you just said that consciousness is subjective experience, hearing sound, feeling pain, and so on, and that this isn't agreeable to everyone. And another guest I've had on the show, well, too, I've spoken to Dan Dennett a couple of times, but I have in mind your friend and co-host of Mind Chat, Keith Frankish, who I had on the show a year or so ago. And they are illusionists about consciousness, as you know. And I'm wondering if this is one group of philosophers who would not find this description of consciousness agreeable.
Yeah, it gets tricky, doesn't it? Because both Dennett early in his career seemed to be much closer to saying consciousness just doesn't exist. But these days they would both say, oh yeah, consciousness exists. It just depends what we mean by consciousness. I mean, the way to pin it down, I think, is to say, insofar as Keith or Dennett believe in quote-unquote consciousness, it's something that's purely behaviorally defined. Now, to be clear, I don't just mean external behavior. I mean also the behavior of parts inside your brain and so on, that cognitive science or neuroscience might reveal. Nonetheless, it's just defined in totally third personal terms, ultimately, in terms of inner or outer behavior. And so to my mind, I guess, and I think most people, my views are controversial, but I don't think this is controversial, what I'm about to say. To my mind, when I talk about the feelings and experiences of others, that is just not what I mean. I'm not making a claim that could be cashed out in purely behavioral terms. If I say, you know, my wife's in pain, that's not a claim about her behavior, either her external behavior or the behavior of her parts. That's not what I'm trying to say. It's about how she feels, and that's a very different kind of a claim, at least at the level of semantic meaning. As I say, most physicalists are also on board with what I've just said in terms of what we mean when we talk about subjective experience. Most physicalists agree with me with that starting point. They will then argue that, you know, we discover or we can explicate consciousness in physical terms, but nonetheless, that's not what we mean. What we mean in the first instance when we talk about consciousness. So yeah, so the Keith Dennett position, I mean, people might not always get this idea because I suppose Dennett is quite a big figure in the mainstream and not many philosophers are, but I think Dennett's type of physicalism and Keith's physicalism is a fairly radical position. Doesn't mean it's wrong, of course. And, I have a fairly radical position myself. But yeah, insofar as I suppose in a sense they are denying the phenomenon, if by the phenomenon we mean something which is not defined in terms of third person behavior, if that's what we mean by consciousness, then they're denying the phenomenon. And of course that's an option, right? You know, I like to consider all kinds of weird and wacky views. I have one myself, so I take that view very seriously. But I think for most people, they are not only on board with that they have this idea of what philosophers sometimes call phenomenal consciousness, subjective experience, but they're pretty damn sure it exists. And that's the starting point for most people on both sides of the debate.
Okay, great. I'd like to flag this term physicalism, and we'll come back to it in a moment. But I just wanted to get one more maybe similarity or difference between these two views that we've just been discussing, yours and then Dennett's and Frankish's, before we move on. And one thing that Dan emphasizes quite often is that consciousness is a spectrum, even though in our sort of folk views of consciousness, it's kind of like an on-off thing. So perhaps we have more mentality than, say, an ant. And I'm wondering if you're on board with this as well, that we ought to think of consciousness as a spectrum.
I don't think I am, but I think that's a stronger claim than the one I've just been making, right? I mm-hmm. think you could be on, as I say, as is the mainstream position, you could be on board with the reality of phenomenal consciousness, subjective experience, but think it comes in a spectrum. There are maybe gray areas between things that are conscious and non-conscious. There's a very interesting paper by the wonderful materialist philosopher Eric Schwitzgebel, who's got a very good new book out, The Weirdness of the World.
We spoke about
audience.
It.
Oh, yeah, cool. I mean, he's got a very interesting recent paper people might want to check out, arguing that consciousness can be vague in that the semi-technical way philosophers use that word to mean allows of borderline cases. So, you know, there's no exact cutoff point between people who are tall and not tall. You know, there's a kind of gray area, or but there's no exact hair number that you need that makes the difference between being bald and not bald. You know, I'm probably in the sort of gray area at the moment, sadly. But could consciousness be like that? Eric thinks it could. You know, that it could be, he thinks, for example, that like snails are in that gray area. So it's not that they have feelings or an inner life. It's not that they don't. It's that they're in the in-between where they neither do and neither don't. It's not just that they have a little bit of consciousness. It's just that it's indeterminate whether there's something that it's like to be a snail. But he admits that's very difficult to make sense of conceptually. So I've argued against that. We could get into that if you like. But I think that's a very substantive claim that goes beyond just being on board with the idea of consciousness and being opposed to physicalism for that matter. Actually, I think even people like on my side of the debate might be happy with it there being a spectrum. But I mean, of course, there are lots of things that exist in a spectrum. And I'm not surprised Dennett says that, because he doesn't believe in phenomenal consciousness. He believes in other sort of more cognitively defined things. And I agree with him that that those things are on a spectrum: intelligence, awareness, cognitive accessibility, and so on. I just don't think phenomenal consciousness is. But Dennett doesn't believe in phenomenal consciousness anyway. So in a sense, there isn't a further disagreement here, if that makes mm-hmm. sense.
The vagueness claim is quite fascinating. I mean, two things that come, of course, vagueness is a very thorny and storied issue in philosophy itself, but two possible responses to this that come to mind are Timothy Williamson's epistemicism. So maybe there is a fact of the matter about whether snails are conscious, but for whatever reason, it's something that we just never will have access to. And then the other possibility that comes to mind is sort of rejecting the coherence of this claim in by pointing out or arguing that consciousness is really a linguistic rather than a physical issue. But I think that would take us too far afield for the moment getting into it. So I'd like to get
just very briefly on that. Yeah, I think you're right. It will quickly get technical, but I mean, Williams and stuff is another very radical claim, another very interesting claim, just for people who are interested in this stuff. Insofar as I've argued that consciousness is not vague, I've worked with the quite mainstream linguistic theory of vagueness and tried to argue that the concept of consciousness doesn't fit with how we think of vague concepts on that theory. So roughly the linguistic theory of vagueness is that vagueness is in our concepts, not out there in reality. I think that's a fairly mainstream position. And I think consciousness being vague doesn't fit with that. So yeah, just in case people want to chase that up. But yeah, we should probably avoid it or it'll get quickly too technical.
Mm-hmm. So I know that there are a few main theories of consciousness, and I'd like to start with two that you think are wrong, but that have been historically or at least are currently dominant. And then those are dualism and then materialism, which you just mentioned, and which ties into physicalism, which also came up when we were talking about Keith and Dan. But so first of all, just how do you like to gloss what these theories are for our listeners who aren't familiar with them?
Yeah, I'm ashamed that I used a bit of jargon there without explaining it. So these were the two classic positions. You know, when I studied philosophy in the dying embers of the 20th century, these were presented as the only choices. So the dualist thinks that consciousness is immaterial outside of the physical workings of the body and the brain. Maybe like Descartes, it's in the soul, although there are other options that the French philosopher, 17th century Descartes, isn't he? Whereas the physicalist position is very roughly that it's just electrochemical signaling in the brain, that consciousness can be in some sense wholly accounted for in terms of the kind of processes physical science deals with, patterns of neural firings and so on. So yeah, they're the two mainstream positions. And yeah, my philosophical undergraduate study, I became deeply disillusioned with these two options and left academia for a bit, or got totally kind of disillusioned with it. And then it was discovering a surprising third option that drew me back in, but maybe we don't want to go there just yet.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we can stick with dualism just for the moment. And you can correct me if you think I'm wrong here, but I think our folk naive, unintuitive idea of consciousness is something like a dualist consciousness, dualist view, in that we're sort of floating above or within or around the physical world. Our minds don't seem physical in the way that rocks are. I'm wondering if you think that this is something like the common sense view, and two, what the main problems with it are for you.
I do think that, yeah. I think dualism has probably been the dominant view of all cultures throughout history. There's a great recent book by Ralph Weir defending dualism, and the first chapter, he defends this idea that, yeah, basically almost everyone in history has been a dualist, and he has some very fun responses to anti-dualism and points out how prevalent anti-dualism is in so many areas of kind of thought and academia in 20th and 21st century. And people have a sort of ethical objection to it on both the right and the left. So he points out, ironically, that sort of, you know, people on the conservative right say, oh, dualism is really bad because it distances from our bodies so we can just do whatever the hell we want with our bodies and have rampant sex and stuff. Whereas people on the left say, oh, dualism is really bad because it distances from our bodies so we can't enjoy rampant sex and stuff. You know, we can't enjoy
the anti-dualist argument from rampant sex.
On both sides. Oh, no, sorry, I said that wrong. So the conservatives say, our body just becomes a sort of plaything because it's not us, so we can just, you know, do what the hell we want with our bodies. Whereas the people on the left say, we're not our bodies, so we can't sort of indulge sensory pleasure and so on. It's not us. But yeah, so it's really fun. And yeah, but I think I'm at least persuaded that most people in history have been dualists. Well, I've changed my mind on the problems of dualism, actually. In my first book aimed at a general audience, Galileo's Error, which is here pictured in UK and US editions. At that point, and in my academic book, so in 2017, I wrote an academic book, Consciousness and Fundamental Reality, pictured here. And at that point, I had the view a lot of philosophers have that we have scientific grounds for doubting dualism. Roughly the idea that, you know, we know enough about the brain to know that everything that happens in the brain has a physical cause within the brain itself. Whereas if dualism were true, and if there were a sort of non-physical soul kind of playing with the brain, you know, every second of waking life, you know, making our arms go up, you know, my conscious thoughts in my soul, making changes in my brain to move my lips and so on, then, you know, that would really show up in our neuroscience. You know, there'd be all sorts of things happening in the brain that had no physical explanation because they're the impact of the soul. It'd be like a poltergeist was playing with the brain. And the thought is that's not what we find in our neuroscience. And so this gives us reason to doubt the truth of dualism. But I've changed my mind on that. Just actually talking to many neuroscientists and many different kinds of scientists, I think that position I just described, that the physical world is a causally closed system, I think many philosophers hold that and many theoretical physicists hold that. People who don't really do that many experiments and sit in their rooms fiddling with equations. I debated Sean Carroll, that you can look on YouTube if you want to check out. Whereas I find lots of, when I talk to more neuroscientists or condensed matter physicists who are, you know, study complex systems, I think, you know, we don't know anywhere near enough about the brain to know if that's true. You know, a book that really influenced me here was Matthew Cobb's book, The Idea of the Brain, which is a sort of intellectual history of our understanding of mind and brain. And the take-home message is we just know very little about how the brain works. You know, people sort of get deceived by brain scans and think, you know, we know a hell of a lot that's going on, but, you know, every pixel of a brain scan corresponds to 5.5 million neurons. And anyway, so I don't really think we know enough about the brain to say whether or not dualism is true on experimental grounds. But I still think dualism is to be avoided just because it's a more complicated position than rivals. You know, as scientists and philosophers, we want to respect Occam's razor. We want to go for the simplest theories that explain the data. And why believe in two kinds of fundamental thing, mental stuff and physical stuff, like the dualist does, if you can just believe in one kind of fundamental stuff at the basic level, as rival theories do. So if, you know, if we're pushed to dualism, and people have some interesting arguments, like Ralph Weir, for example, who I just mentioned, but at the moment I'm not yet convinced that there is good philosophical reason to accept dualism, and so we should go for a more simple and more parsimonious alternative.
That is very interesting. I'd never heard about this before, heard that explanation before. I understand that it's not something you find compelling anymore, but the idea that we might, if dualism were true, we would look into the brain and see things apparently moving without apparent causes, and that's very fascinating. The problem that I thought you were going to point to was the interaction problem, which, maybe that's not a technical term. It might be, but what I have in mind is, I think Descartes wanted some sort of mechanism for how the immaterial could interact with the material, and he posited that something was going on in the pineal gland.
Yeah. Well, I think what it gave is maybe a form of the interaction problem. I mean, in general, we can think of the interaction problem as just, how does something non-physical impact the physical body, the physical brain? As you say, I mean, this was pressed on Descartes by Princess Elizabeth of Bohemia, who Descartes was the tutor of, and she made him get up very early in the morning, which resulted in him dying from pneumonia at 42, I think. But anyway, I think people are less worried these days. I mean, you often, it's ironic, actually, you do, that is still what you get in first year philosophy courses is, oh, you know, just how can something mental affect something physical? But I think these days, most people sort of working more specifically on consciousness on either side of the debate will accept the point someone like David Chalmers might make, who's probably the most famous contemporary dualist, that, well, look, any fundamental causal interaction is just brute and inexplicable. You know, like scientists, you know, whatever, we try to get down to the basic equations of physics, these mathematical principles that tell us what stuff does. Then if you ask, well, why does stuff obey these equations? You just say, well, it just does, right? That's the end of the, there was a famous line where someone asked Newton, why do things obey the law of gravity? And he said, I don't frame hypotheses in Latin, meaning, you know, I've just give you the equations, shut up. So if that's okay for anybody to just say, well, you know, the laws of physics are just basic and inexplicable, why can't the dualists just add their own additional basic causal principles connecting up consciousness and the physical world? David Chalmers calls these psychophysical laws of nature, just basic laws as basic as the laws of physics that connect up in a lawful way consciousness and physical reality. And, you know, Chalmers calls himself a naturalistic dualist. He's not into anything spooky, supernatural. He doesn't believe in God. He wants to understand this scientifically, these new causal principles. So of course that makes the theory less parsimonious. They're believing in something additional, but it doesn't seem any principal problem. So this is why the contemporary form of the interaction problem tends to be more rooted in this scientific premise that we know it can't be true because it would show up in the brain. You know, the interaction of the soul would show up in the brain. We see it's not there. So it's less a philosophical worry in a way. It's more a sort of scientifically based thing. I'm just less and less convinced that we know enough science to justify that.
Yeah. So you said that, I mean, for that reason, at this point, you haven't been persuaded by dualism and you're in search of a more parsimonious account. And physicalism, as you said, is the thesis that consciousness is just physical process in the brain. And first, are physicalism and materialism the same? And second, I mean, physicalism, as you expressed it, it seems pretty parsimonious. So why is this one insufficient for you as well?
Physicalism, materialism, I guess I tend to use those interchangeably. I perhaps use the word materialism more in my work aimed at a general audience. Maybe the word materialism is a bit more familiar to a general audience, and the word physicalism more in my academic work. Although these days, actually, I tend to just use physicalism. But yeah, I think sometimes people use materialism more for a view rooted in a 16th or 17th century conception of matter, such as Descartes had, or Thomas Hobbes, who is a contemporary of Descartes and a materialist, and maybe physicalism for a conception of the physical world that's rooted more in 21st century physics. But I just use these words interchangeably. So yeah, what's wrong with it? It's certainly a parsimonious theory, so that's not my problem with it. That is a good point of it. I suppose, I mean, look, what I am most passionate about conveying on this topic is that this is not just a scientific issue, right? We have at the core here a philosophical problem, what has traditionally been known as the mind-body problem, which is just the issue of how consciousness and the physical world connect together, right? So one theory, the physicalist theory, is that physical reality is fundamental and consciousness emerges from physical reality. The panpsychist theory I prefer puts it the other way around, that consciousness is fundamental and physical reality emerges from underlying facts about consciousness. Now, crucially, both of these theories are empirically equivalent, which means that you can't do an experiment, unlike maybe with dualism in certain forms, you can't do an experiment to distinguish these views, because for any scientific data, each theory just interprets it on their own terms. So this is why this is a philosophical rather than a scientific issue. So how do we decide between them if it's, you know, people think physicalism is the scientific option and other views are sort of metaphysical speculation. I just dispute that starting point. I think the scientific data is just neutral on all these options. So how do we choose between them? Well, I think we just assess them on their own terms and look at, for example, how well they live up to their explanatory obligations, their explanatory aspirations. So physicalism wants to explain consciousness in terms of physical processes in the brain. Panpsychism, the view I prefer, wants to turn that explanatory task on its head. It wants to start with consciousness and explain physical reality in terms of consciousness. So I just think we have to ask, you know, how plausible are each of these explanatory projects? How well have they gone? I think the physicalist one has never got anywhere, and there are good reasons to think it's not actually a coherent project. Whereas the panpsychist one, I think we've already worked out how to do it. We've solved all the mysteries. It feels a bit culturally weird, but it's, you know, we know how to do it. And so it's just, to my mind, a much more plausible explanatory project than the physicalist one.
Well, I very much want to come back and focus on panpsychism's having solved all of these mysteries, because that's a very strong claim. But I still want to talk a bit about why you think the physicalist program is unsuccessful, in part because, I mean, by the time this episode comes out, I will have had a joint episode come out with Steve Pinker, Dennett, and Sean Carroll, where we talk a little bit about this. And I've spoken a lot about physical theories of consciousness on the show, but not panpsychism. So science has a terrific track record with solving problems. And if you talk to somebody like Dan, he will point out that it has been very successful to this point in discovering the neural correlates of consciousness, the so-called NCCs. So I'm wondering why you think that it has been so unsuccessful and why it won't be able to account for consciousness in a satisfactory way.
Good. Just on Steven Pinker, actually, I would say, from what I've heard of Steven Pinker and read in his work, he is much closer to my position, actually, than either Dennett or Sean Carroll. My understanding was that he's some kind of Mysterian view, that is, that there are principled reasons why we just can't understand how consciousness emerges. Maybe there are properties of the brain that we can never get at. I think that's very different to the standard physicalist position that no, we can just explain it in terms of the kind of stuff physical science talks about. And I'm much more sympathetic to that view. I had one of the debates I'd had that you can get on my website with Rebecca Goldstein, his wife, who has the similar Mysterian view. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Well, it's very important to distinguish the philosophical problem I was just talking about with the science of consciousness. I'm not saying the science of consciousness has not got anywhere. And to my mind, broadly speaking, the difference is that the scientific task is to work out which kinds of brain activity go along with which kinds of conscious experience, as you said, the tracking the NCCs, the neural correlates of consciousness. That's a very important scientific task. I mean, it is still a bit of a mess, but you know, I'm hopeful about that project. But I think, again, I think whatever that project delivers is neutral on the philosophical question. So that the scientific question is which brain activity goes with consciousness. The philosophical question is why? Why does brain activity go along with consciousness at all? Right? And there are these different options, right? Maybe the physical world is first and consciousness pops up. Consciousness is first, the physical world pops up. Or maybe, like the dualist, they're both fundamental but radically different. So the scientific data is just neutral on that. But to get straight to your question, your central question, I mean, first, I think that we haven't solved what David Chalmers called the hard problem of consciousness, the challenge of explaining how electrochemical signaling in the brain could somehow produce an inner world of colors and sounds and smells and tastes. I would say, you know, not only have we not got the full story, but we haven't really managed to explain a single subjective experience in terms of patterns of neural firing. We've correlated, right? But we haven't got any even the beginnings of an explanation. Okay, but you might say, well, there's just more time. And what I think motivates a lot of people, as you said there, Robinson, is, you know, the great track record of science. Maybe we just need more time. Well, what I do in again going back to Galileo's error and my academic book is to have a slightly different spin on the history of science. I trace the problem of consciousness back to its intellectual foundations philosophical foundations of the scientific revolution, in Galileo's decision to put consciousness outside of science in order to allow science to be mathematical. So before Galileo, you know, people thought the world is filled with these qualities, colors, sounds, smells, tastes, and took it quite rightly, in my view, that you can't capture these qualities in the purely quantitative vocabulary of mathematics. So the idea that we could describe everything in mathematics was seemed to be absurd, because you know, an equation can't capture that deep red you experience as you watch the setting sun. So this was a challenge for Galileo. Galileo got around it by saying, well, all of these qualities that seem to fill the world, the colors, the sounds, the smells, the tastes, they're not really in the physical world. They're in consciousness, in the soul. That's outside of science. So he strips the world of these qualities so that all that remains can be captured in the purely quantitative language of mathematics. And that was the start of mathematical physics. It was premised on this radical philosophical worldview that took consciousness outside of the domain of science. Now, that project has gone really well, but it was only ever intended as a limited project, putting consciousness on one side, going for what you can capture in mathematics. So, you know, the fact that physical science has gone so well since we took consciousness out doesn't, I think, give us grounds to think, oh, it's going to be the same once we bring consciousness back in. And ultimately, you know, I think, getting a bit long-winded, but there's a big discussion here. But ultimately, I think what physical science works well at, what it's all about really, is accounting for publicly observable behavior, right? Whether it's a complex living system, explaining it in terms of simpler mechanisms, ultimately postulating basic laws of physics that explain those more complicated forms of behavior. This is what the project is. This is what it's been so good at. This is what's given us incredible technologies, explaining publicly observable behavior. But that's just not what we're trying to do when we're trying to explain consciousness. We're not trying to explain some publicly observable behavior. We're trying to explain this inner world of colors and sounds and smells and tastes. It's just a totally different explanatory project. And, you know, there are a lot of steps to the argument, but I think it just doesn't make sense to we can't sort of capture these subjective qualities, what it's like to see red, what it's like to taste coffee, in the purely quantitative language of physical science. That's not what it's ever been aimed at, and it's not coherent to apply. It's like saying, you know, oh, telescopes have been really good in astronomy. Maybe they'll be good in pure math. You know, it's just a totally different explanatory project. So I think there's just a sort of deep confusion at the root here. But obviously it's a big debate. Sorry, that was a very long answer.
No, that was absolutely terrific. And there's one last thing I want to ask about in this same vein, and I think you've just kind of touched on it. But one common refrain I've heard from the physicalist, I think I've probably heard this from Sean Carroll, which is that if you're saying that science can't account for consciousness in the way that we want it to, does this would mean that our best theories of physics, like quantum field theory, are wrong and need to be revised? But my guess, and then the physicalist like Sean Carroll would say, but quantum field theory is so successful, there is really nothing to revise here. And my guess is your response would be, right, there's nothing to revise here. The science is great. It can be confirmed to 14 decimal points, but it's just not in the business of explaining consciousness, which is why we need something outside of the physicalist paradigm to do that.
Absolutely.
Okay, perfect.
And yeah, I mean, people could watch the debate I had with him to go back and forth on this. But I think, I mean, one of the advantages of the panpsychist position I defend, one of the reasons it's come to be a still minority, but a position it's taking very seriously, is that at least in certain forms, it aspires to not interfere with the physics, just leave the physics as it is. Just great. Offer a deeper layer of explanation underneath the physics, right? So we're not adding new forces and so on. I mean, there are other forms of panpsychism that do have implications for the physics, and I've also debated that a little bit with Sean. I think, I mean, as Sean agrees, the experiments on which we base our current understanding of physics generally involve very small numbers of particles, you know, particle colliders and so on. So it's not like we've tested whether these same equations exactly apply in living systems like brains. You know, we just have no capacity to do that. Now, Sean presses, well, we may have some theoretical reasons to think that these same equations are going to apply at higher levels. Still, I think it's important to distinguish those kind of theoretical considerations with like observing in the brain and seeing whether those equations are kept to. Sean agrees with me that we haven't done that. So insofar as we're thinking of more abstract theoretical reasons in physics, we might have to balance that against abstract philosophical reasons and, you know, weigh those things up. I don't think I'm saying anything Sean would disagree with at that point. But anyway, the basic panpsychist position does not necessarily involve fiddling with the physics at all, which is seen as a big advantage of it.
Okay, terrific. Well, now, without any further ado, we can move on to panpsychism, which, as you said earlier, and which I'm very excited to hear about, has solved all the mysteries. So what, I guess, in a nutshell, is panpsychism? And you also said that, or you pointed to some literature that argues that dualism has been the most common view. But how long has panpsychism been around?
Panpsychism has been around as long as philosophy, as far as we know, in both East and West. You know, there's a long tradition. Big Enlightenment philosophers, you know, Leibniz, Spinoza have something at least close to a panpsychist view. Had something of a heyday in the 19th century. Fell out of favor in the post-war years. I think there was a strong materialist turn at this point and an anti-metaphysics turn. And it's only in the last 10 or 15 years, maybe pushing 20 years now, that there's been a return of taking panpsychism seriously as a third option that needs to be on the table, needs to be reckoned with. But panpsychism is essentially the view that consciousness goes all the way down to the fundamental building blocks of reality. It doesn't literally mean that everything is conscious. The basic idea is that the basic building blocks of reality have some kind of very simple subjective experience, and that the very complex experience of the human or animal brain is somehow built up from consciousness, at these simple forms of consciousness at the level of basic physics. So a panpsychist needn't think this cup is conscious, has its own unified conscious experience, but they may very well think the smallest particles making up the cup have some kind of very simple experience. That's the basic position.
Mm-hmm. And as you've said a few times, it's a pretty radical position. What motivates it, other than the rejection of dualism and physicalism?
As I say, I think we just need to, as you would in science, you know, you got some data, you look at the different theories and see how well they do. So I think the data here is it's not scientific data, it's philosophical data. What is the data that well, is it scientific or is it philosophical? It's kind of difficult because consciousness is not something we know about from experiments. It's not, you know, we didn't discover it looking down a microscope. We know about consciousness just because you're immediately aware of your feelings and experiences. But anyway, what we know is that consciousness and the physical world are correlated in some way, right? I take it that's the starting point. Certain kinds of brain activity bring up, let me say that more carefully. I nearly slipped into physicalism then. Certain kinds of brain activity are correlated with certain kinds of conscious experience. That's, everyone agrees on that. What's the best explanation of that? There's the dualist option. Well, not very simple. Let's try and avoid that. And then there's the physicalist and the panpsychist option. And you just have to look at how well they do at their explanations. I've said the physicalist doesn't do very well at the attempt to explain consciousness in terms of physical processes in the brain. The panpsychist tries to do it the other way around. Starts off with consciousness and tries to explain physical reality in terms of underlying facts about consciousness. So you see, so if consciousness and physical reality are correlated, connected together, there's two ways of explaining that. Maybe the physical world is the first thing and consciousness pops out, or maybe consciousness is the first thing and the physical world pops out. And I just think the panpsychist has a much clearer, it's got an explanation, it's got a workable explanation for how to make sense of physical reality popping out of consciousness, whereas the physicalist attempt, for all the reasons I've given, doesn't look so hot. So should I tell you about that, how they try to explain it, or?
Sure. Well, let me know if this question that I, let me ask a question, you can tell me if it comes, if it's better answered after the explanation. But just clarifying this idea of philosophical data. And so is the philosophical data that electrons or strings have some primitive mentality, the data that we know that brain activity and mental activity are correlated, but we don't have a good physical answer for that? So it's sort of this idea that strings, electrons, primitive particles have mentality just follows from this?
I wouldn't say it's the data that strings or particles have consciousness. That's part of the hypothesis to explain the data. Yeah, I mean, we don't have
that's what I meant.
Yeah, right. So the data is just, you know, that there are these, you know, there are these two things we know about in quite different ways. That's why this is another way of saying why it's not a straightforward scientific issue. You know, science is about accounting for observable data, experimental data, whereas here it's we've got the experiment. There's two things we know about in quite different ways. There's the physical world we know about with our senses and through doing science, and then there's consciousness that we know about just through being conscious, right? You can't see consciousness. I can't look in your brain and see your experiences. We just know about it because we are conscious. And we know these two things are connected. And the question is, how are they connected? That's the question. And the panpsychist says, well, consciousness is at the fundamental level and the physical world emerges from consciousness, and that's why they're connected.
Okay, great. And so, what are the best arguments for panpsychism?
Well, I would say the attraction of panpsychism is the explanation it is able to offer of how physical reality emerges from underlying facts about consciousness. And here we really get to this all goes back to the influence of Bertrand Russell and certain really important pioneering work Russell did in the 1920s. I think we should think of Russell as the Darwin of consciousness. I think he cracked it. But basically, Russell was focusing on The fact that physics is purely mathematical, this is what I think in the 1920s he was really spending a lot of time wrestling with, which is something we kind of take for granted, but was a quite revolutionary innovation of Galileo in the 17th century, that right from now on our basic science is going to be totally mathematical. Now, of course, that's very useful if you're a working physicist, right, to get very precise predictions. Mathematics is great. But Russell's thinking, well, what does it mean as a philosopher interested in the fundamental nature of reality that our basic science is just mathematics? And what Russell decided it meant is that physics isn't really telling us that much about what physical reality is. It's just describing its mathematical structure. As far as physics is concerned, fundamental reality could turn out to be anything. Physical reality could be anything. As long as it has the right mathematical structure, you're going to be able to get physics out of that. So the panpsychist exploits this in the following way. So their story is, what we have at the fundamental level of reality are very simple conscious entities interacting in simple, predictable ways. Through their interactions, they realize certain patterns, certain mathematical structures. And then the idea is those mathematical structures just are what we call physics. So you get physics out of underlying facts about consciousness. It's perhaps put vividly by, you know, Stephen Hawking famously said on the last page of A Brief History of Time, even a final theory of physics won't tell us what breathes fire into the equations and makes a universe for them to describe. So for the panpsychist, it's consciousness that breathes fire into the equations. Okay, so what? So how does this give us reason to believe panpsychism? Well, that I think this is an intelligible. Let's put it this way: panpsychism has solved its own hard problem. The hard problem for the physicalist is, how does consciousness emerge from physical processes in the brain? I don't think the physicalist has managed to solve that. The panpsychist's hard problem is, how does physical reality emerge from consciousness? And I think we have solved that. We know how to make sense of that. I think Russell gave us a totally satisfactory explanation. So we have this comprehensible account, theory, explanation of how consciousness and the physical world fit together, which I don't think the physicalist is able to do. So it's that explanatory success, I think, that is the crucial motivation for panpsychism.
One objection to panpsychism that I wanted to raise, in my mind, it's analogous to the interaction problem with dualism, where, just to remind our listeners, it's this problem of how the immaterial interacts with the material. How is it that the mentality of these microscopic particles, the fundamental physical constituents of the world, combine to create this unified sense of consciousness in me? What is the interaction here that gives me a unified sense of consciousness, but doesn't give the mug that you raised and pointed to earlier a sense of consciousness?
Good. So when you said interaction problem, I was thinking you were going to say, how does the consciousness at the level of particles interact with the physical stuff? And if you'd have said that, I would say, well, that's a dualistic quite common dualistic interpretation of panpsychism, where you've got, you know, the physical properties of the particles, mass and spin and charge, and then these weird consciousness properties. How do they interact? Sabine Hossenfelder had a blog post a few years ago, you know, raising this objection to panpsychism, saying, you know, this would show up in our physics as well as their physical properties, particles had these weird non-physical consciousness properties. But that's not the view. As I said earlier, the view is that there is the consciousness, the fundamental consciousness underlies the mathematical structures of physics. So we can keep the standard model of particle physics exactly as it is, those beautiful mathematical structures physics gives us, we just say, look, there's this other layer underneath that story. Okay, so if there was an interact, I think that would fit more with what
makes
sense to me to call an interaction problem. But you did raise what is generally seen as the biggest challenge of panpsychism, commonly referred to as the combination problem. Okay, we postulate these little conscious things. How do they come together to make our consciousness or the consciousness of other animals? You know, that's what we ultimately want to explain. So this is, you know, this is a very serious issue that the energies of the contemporary panpsychist research program are focused on. And there, you know, there are lots of interesting proposals, and it's very early days. I mean, we could talk through some of the options. I suppose to my mind, even if at the end of the day, I guess I'm more and more sympathetic to, well, let me rephrase that. Even if at the end of the day, we have to just add, we just have to take this as primitive. We just have to say, look, it's just a primitive fact about conscious particles that they, in certain circumstances, they combine into unified conscious wholes. And it's a scientific question when that happens. But even let's say at the end of the day, we just have to take that as a brute extra fact. Well, I still think panpsychism is a very attractive theory. Why? Because I think its central explanatory advantage is its capacity to explain physical reality in terms of consciousness, and thus to bottom out in a very simple parsimonious theory of reality, right? We said that's ultimately what we want. We want to explain everything in terms of one kind of fundamental stuff. The physicalist tries to reduce everything to physical stuff. I don't think they succeed at that, but the panpsychist shows us how to reduce everything to consciousness. And I think they have shown us how to do that. Now, if they can also explain our consciousness in terms of combinations of conscious particles, fantastic. That's a bonus. But even if they can't do that, even if there's just an extra primitive there, still their theory only commits to one fundamental kind of property or stuff, consciousness stuff. And I think is very simple in that regard. So I still, so I think, you know, there's lots to say about a combination problem, but, you know, even if we, that never gets solved in a satisfactory way, I still think panpsychism is superior to those two traditional rivals.
There are two extensions or issues that might be related to panpsychism that I want to make sure that we touch on before we talk about why, the purpose of the universe. And the first is parapsychology. And Sean recently gave a very nice explanation for why parapsychology does not work on a physicalist perspective, because it would require new physics. But I am wondering if panpsychism is, or leaves parapsychology more open. And I have in mind things like mind reading, maybe telekinesis, just things like this.
I don't think so. You know, I was on a very good podcast, Waking Cosmos podcast, been on a couple of times. And the first time I was on, the host asked me, yeah, it does panpsychism help you with believing in sort of psi phenomena and so on? I'm not sure it does, actually. I mean, I think you, look, suppose we discovered, you know, for sure that there is telepathy. Well, I think a physicalist could in principle accommodate that with, you know, non-local connections between brains. Now, look, that's not to disagree with what Sean said. I can understand that that would be very challenging. It would mean, you know, uprooting a lot of assumptions of perhaps of the non-locality principle that's kind of assumed in a lot of fundamental physics. But I don't think it would mean departing from physicalism. You can still think everything's physical. There are just these non-local connections. I mean, we know about quantum entanglement. Before people email me that I'm being an idiot, I know you can't communicate with quantum entanglement. I'm not sure I understand why you can't, but I know you can't. But I'm just saying, insofar as we can have these non-local connections consistent with physicalism, you could have other non-local connections that allow for telepathy. So I'm not sure it does, actually. And I'm always very careful. You know, people often ask me, I'm good friends with Rupert Sheldrake, who claims to have empirical grounds for believing in such phenomena. And, you know, he's an interesting guy and makes his case. But, you know, as a philosopher, it's not my skill set to evaluate. You know, people often ask me what I think about it. It's not my skill set to evaluate empirically based stuff. So I always have to, insofar as I appeal to science, I'm just very careful that I have to appeal to science in which there's a fair bit of consensus. Like I've talked about fine tuning, for example, which we might get onto. That's like not very controversial physics. The implications of it are, and that's more my skill set. But the science, I would just, where it might help. Just finally, I talk about this a little bit in Galileo's Era and maybe my new book, Why the Purpose of the Universe. I suggest it might help us if you take mystical experiences seriously, right? So a lot of people, one of the boxes you tick on the psychological test for a mystical experience is a sense that there is a living presence in all things. Or there's often a sense that there's some kind of consciousness at the root of things. Now, if you're a physicalist, you've got to think that's a delusion, right? But if you're a panpsychist and you already think there's consciousness at the fundamental level of reality, it's not so much of a leap to think maybe mystical experiences are revealing to us something about that. Now, let me be very clear. I know that's not to say we should believe mystical experiences as opposed to thinking they're delusions. You know, there's an interesting question about the rationality, the epistemology there. I'm just saying, clearly a panpsychist worldview would be more consonant with certain mystical traditions that have consciousness at the fundamental level. But again, and I'll definitely stop with this, I just want to emphasize, there's quite a divide among panpsychists. Some panpsychists take it in a spiritual direction. Other panpsychists think, oh no, this is superstitious nonsense. We're just interested in normal consciousness, feeling pain, seeing red. We think we need a new paradigm of explanation, but we're total atheist secularists. So you needn't take it in that direction, but you might.
Well, you said fine tuning, which gets me really excited. So I just want to blast through this last thing that I wanted to ask you about. I've mentioned a lot of names, but part of that is it is nice to be constantly reevaluating things that have come up on the show. But I recently spoke with Robert Sapolsky about his views on free will or the lack thereof. And philosophers like Dan Dennett are compatibilists in the sense that they believe in free will and its compatibility with determinism, or even if the world is not ultimately deterministic, with physics, however physics plays out. But I'm wondering if as a panpsychist, you sort of follow Dennett's or Sean Carroll's views on free will, or if there is a different way of going about arguing for free will that sort of preserves maybe Sapolsky's intuitions about what free will ought to be.
I mean, firstly, panpsychists can think all sorts of different things on this, and I'm okay. Somewhat agnostic. You know, Luke Roloff's a very good panpsychist who's a compatibilist. You know, as you say, that is a kind of consensus position in philosophy. I'm not convinced by the case of people like Sapolsky that we know enough empirical facts to rule out strong libertarian free will. Although that doesn't mean it exists. But actually, well, one of the interesting things in my new book, for me, the big challenge with, perhaps the biggest challenge for a libertarian worldview where there's this, you know, very strong free will that's where we have some decisions that lack prior causes. One of the big challenges is most libertarians think this kind of causation, human agency, is radically different from the kind of causation we find in the inanimate world and maybe in the rest of the biological world. You know, in the biological world, in the inanimate world, you know, things are compelling other things to do stuff. You know, the toy example of the billiard ball hits the other billiard ball, makes it fly across the room. Whereas in human beings, suddenly we can freely choose without any prior causes. Well, what I sketch out in the consciousness chapter of my new book is a view I call panagentialism, where in a sense, not just consciousness, but the roots of agency go all the way down to the fundamental level. And I suggest there's a coherent picture, consistent with everything we know empirically, according to which, in a sense, particles are very, very crude kind of agent or proto-agent, that they are never compelled to act, rather they are other particles inducing them certain inclinations to act, and then they follow their inclinations. And then the thought is, because particles are kind of really stupid, they can't rationally deliberate, they don't understand stuff, they're inevitably going to follow their inclinations. So if you're a, I don't know whether to take any of that again, because I got a bit, whether to go back a bit.
I think it was good.
Yeah, it was okay. You know, if you're a mature human being and you feel like doing something, you have a desire to do something, you can deliberate, you can think, is this a good idea? Maybe I don't want to lash out in anger. Maybe I don't want to eat the unhealthy food. But if you're, say, a very young infant and you desire something, you're going to go for it, right? So the thought is, because particles are just this very, the simplest conceivable kind of agent, they, because they can't rationally deliberate and have any of these more sophisticated responses, they inevitably just follow their desires, and that's why we get a predictable world. Anyway, that's just a, just I spell this out in much more detail. One attraction of this position is, if you're a libertarian, you have a much more, what I always like, a more unified, simple picture of reality. Human consciousness is not just, sorry, human agency is not this radically new thing, human free will. It's just a highly evolved form of what exists right down to the basic level of physics. So, so I'm not sure that view is right, but I think it removes, to my mind, the most serious objection to libertarianism. I'm not persuaded by either the scientific or the philosophical arguments against libertarian free will. So the availability of this panagentialist view does, I think, leave open the reality of libertarian free will as a serious live option. I mean, that doesn't mean it does exist. The reality of free will is much less certain, at least, than the reality of consciousness. You know, it's much more possible that we're under the illusion that we have free will than we are under the illusion that we're feeling pain or something. So I'm somewhat agnostic.
Well, at the beginning of our conversation, I mentioned that consciousness was at the top of my list of most pressing questions for philosophers and scientists. And you just mentioned another one that is just in the top two or three for me, and that is the fine-tuning problem. So I would be very curious to hear, I mean, one, how you sort of explain the fine-tuning problem for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, and two, how you go about addressing it in the purpose of the universe.
Good. Yeah, it's a fascinating problem, and it's just something that's captured me in the last few years, actually. It's the surprising discovery of recent decades that for life to be possible, certain numbers in physics had to be like Goldilocks porridge, just right, you know. Perhaps the example that's most baffled cosmologists revolves around dark energy, the force which pushes apart the universe. We know now, since the end of the 90s, our universe is not just expanding, it's accelerating in its expansion. So physicists postulate a force that's pushing things apart we call dark energy. Now, when we measured dark energy, we discovered it's a quite surprising number. It's like really tiny, but not quite zero, which physicists say is a really weird number to find in basic physics. But it's fortunate it is that of that form, because if it was a bit bigger, the force would have been a bit stronger. Everything would have shot apart so quickly that no two particles would have ever met. We wouldn't have had stars, planets, any kind of structural complexity. Whereas if it had been less than zero, it's very close to zero. If it had been less than zero, it wouldn't have counteracted gravity, and the whole universe would have collapsed back on itself a split second after the Big Bang. So for life to be possible, for any kind of interesting chemistry to be possible, that number had to be in this very narrow range, just right, not too strong, not too weak, like Goldilocks porridge, just right. So look, there's a huge debate here. I get into all of the objections, I hope, in the book, but ultimately I think we face a dilemma. You know, either this is just an incredible fluke that these numbers in our physics, I just gave one example, there are many, that these numbers are just right for life, and I think it is, when you look into it, it's too improbable to take seriously, or those numbers in physics are as they are because they are right for life. In other words, that there is some kind of goal-directedness towards life at the fundamental level, at the very early stage of the universe. Now, that's weird. That's not how we imagine science to be. But I think we're sort of, at the moment, in denial about this for cultural reasons, because it's not how we imagine science to be. And, you know, I think it's a little bit like in the 16th century where we started getting evidence that we're not in the center of the universe, and people couldn't handle that and tried to wish it away and explain it in all sorts of ad hoc ways. And now we look back and think, oh, those stupid religious people, why didn't they just follow the evidence? But I think every generation absorbs a worldview it can't see beyond. And I think something like that's going on with fine-tuning now. I think future historians looking back will think, how did they just ignore this evidence for so long? So what I try to argue in the book, I don't like the, most people think go to the God hypothesis, that God fiddled with the numbers. I don't like that hypothesis either, for reasons we could perhaps get into. But I think it is evidence for what I call cosmic purpose, some kind of fundamental future goal directedness. And we just have to put aside our biases, both religious and secular, and just follow the evidence where it leads. And this is what I try to make sense of in the book. Why? And maybe panpsychism can help us a little bit with that.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to ask is this related, this cosmic purpose, is it related on your view to the pan-agentialism that we were just discussing? Maybe in the same way that my consciousness emerges from the, on the panpsychist view, from the primitive mentality of all these parts of me, does the universe's agency or purpose arise from the pan-agentialism or the agency of all its components?
I don't think quite pan-agentialism can help with this problem. I use pan-agentialism to address a different set of challenges to do with the evolution of consciousness and why natural selection didn't just make very complicated survival mechanisms with no conscious experience, but just programmed to survive very well. That's where the pan-agentialism goes. But I don't think pan-agentialism helps with fine-tuning, in fact. I mean, in the book, I actually consider a range of hypotheses. You know, why I don't like the God hypothesis is the familiar problem of evil, the challenge of reconciling an all-loving, powerful God with the terrible suffering we find in the universe. Why would a God let that happen? One possibility I consider is just sort of tweaking the properties of the cosmic designer. You know, maybe it's a bad designer, or a designer of limited abilities who's just made the best universe she can. Or maybe the Nick Bostrom simulation hypothesis, that maybe we're in a computer simulation and our designer is just some random computer programmer. So that's one possibility. I also take seriously a sort of primitivism about cosmic purpose. Maybe it's just a basic fact about reality that it aims at these goals and that there isn't a sort of consciousness underlying that. It's just a primitive fact about this goal-directedness. Aristotle, for example, thought the world was filled with purposes and goals without there being a designer that had embedded them. But finally, and this is how what does connect to the panpsychism, I think my favorite hypothesis is cosmopsychism, the idea that the universe itself is a conscious mind with its own goals. A very different, alien, weird kind of conscious mind, very different to a naturally evolved mind. But I try to suggest this isn't as extravagant as you might at first think, and fits with panpsychism, which I think is an independently plausible solution to the philosophical consciousness problems, and offers a quite surprisingly parsimonious solution to the fine-tuning problem. You know, why postulate a cosmic designer outside the universe if we can just think, you know, maybe the universe is conscious and it fine-tuned itself?
Well, Philip, this has been absolutely terrific. It has been so worth the wait an hour, a few times we've rescheduled. So thank you so much for having this conversation with me, and thank you so much for working on such radical and interesting ideas.
Oh, thank you very much, Robinson. It's been a really good chat. Keep up the good work.
Okay.